Okay, Genesis chapter 26 is the only chapter in the Bible devoted exclusively to Isaac. Isaac is a relatively unimportant person, except for the fact that he provides an essential link between Abraham and the later generations. He didn't really do anything original. All the chapters other than this one that mention him in connection either with his father or with his sons. Of course, he's in some of the stories about Abraham, and he's in some of the stories about Jacob and Esau. But already by the end of chapter 25, Jacob and Esau have sort of taken center stage. And then from chapter 27 on, they're going to be kind of the center of attention again. Chapter 26 is stuck in there just so that, almost to give Isaac a little bit of attention of his own, but the attention that's given isn't very impressive. He doesn't do anything original. He makes the same mistake his father does in saying that his wife is his sister. So that's not even original. And then he spends the rest of his life digging wells, but not original wells. He's redigging the wells that Abraham had dug. And he doesn't even give them original names. He gives them the same names that Abraham gave them. In other words, this guy is just maintaining. This is a maintenance generation. No ground is lost and no ground is gained, except that another generation passes and a significant child, Jacob, comes to be born in it. But I don't know exactly what was in Moses' mind in writing this, in giving so little attention to Isaac and recording only such things about him that are entirely unoriginal behaviors of his. It might be just a way of saying that there are seasons in God's overall dealings where he's, doing significant things through somebody, and he's going to do significant things in the future through somebody, but there's a generation between that not much is happening. Certainly that is true of the history of the church. It's been true of the history of revivals, that there'll be a revival in one generation and a revival in a later generation, but in between there's, the church just kind of maintaining, just kind of holding the ground. Hopefully not losing ground, but God has his spurts of activity in history, and other times in between those spurts, the obligation of the people of God is simply to not lose the ground and to keep the traditions going of the previous spurt until the next one comes. And that's really all that Isaac seems to do. It says, there was a famine in the land, besides the first famine that was in the days of Abraham, and Isaac went to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, in Gerar. Now, the first famine that was in the days of Abraham was back in Genesis chapter 12, and that had caused Abraham to leave the promised land and go down to Egypt, where he had, of course, endangered Sarah by saying that she was his sister. Isaac at least doesn't go down to Egypt. He doesn't leave the land. It's clear that Abraham did not want Isaac to ever leave the land. He wouldn't even let him go down to Paddan Aram, or up to Paddan Aram, to find a wife. Instead, he had to send a servant. And when the servant said, well, if she won't come, shall I take him? No, God forbid, don't let my son leave this country. And Isaac apparently picked up on that sentiment. And instead of going down to Egypt and leaving the promised land, he stayed in the land. But he went to live in the region of Gerar. It's possible that Gerar was importing food from Egypt or something, so that during the famine times there was more to be had there. And Isaac was wealthy, so he could buy grain from him if they had it. And then the Lord appeared to him and said, do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land in which I shall tell you, of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and your descendants I will give these lands, and I will perform the oath which I swore to Abraham your father. And I will make your descendants multiply as the stars of heaven. I will give to your descendants all these lands, and in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, and my statutes and my laws. Now God gives Isaac a promise, but it's just the same promise he gave to Abraham. In fact, he even says, I'm going to do this for you because of Abraham. Not because you're special necessarily, but because your father Abraham obeyed me, I'm going to do this for you. And he does say, stay in the land and I'll bless you here. Even though there was a famine, God did bless him, as we shall see before the chapter's over. He actually farmed and made and got quite a harvest. So Isaac dwelt in Gerar, and the men of the place asked him about his wife, and he said, "She's my sister." For he was afraid to say, "She's my wife," because he thought, "Lest the men of the place should kill me for Rebekah, because she is a beautiful woman to behold." Now it came to pass, when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked through a window and saw, and there was Isaac showing endearment to Rebekah, his wife. Showing endearment literally means caressing. The King James says sporting with his wife. I think most would assume this means what we would call petting, caressing her, acting, you know, intimate with her in a way that a man and his sister would not do. And therefore, Abimelech put it together. The penny dropped, and he said, "Wait a minute. Quite obviously, she's your wife." Now, Isaac and Rebekah were doing this, what, in public? Out in front of everybody? Not very wise if he's trying to convince people she's his sister. At least in this case, unlike Abram, she never was taken from Isaac. She never had to be restored to him from some harem of a king. But this king did realize that there had been that danger of it happening, and he rebuked Isaac for that. But maybe they weren't in public. Maybe Abimelech and they had, you know, buildings, you know, across from each other. Sort of like David could look from his window and see Bathsheba bathing on her rooftop. You know, I mean, maybe they were in different buildings, but he could see through the window. Anyway, maybe Abimelech was a voyeur anyway, and was, you know, had his binoculars there at the window, and when he saw this happening, he said, "Wait, I guess she's not really available. She's his wife." And he says, "Quite obviously, she's your wife. So how could you say she's my sister?" And Isaac said to him, "Because I said, lest I die on account of her." Very heroic. "I don't want to die for her." But the Bible says that that's exactly what a husband's supposed to do. In Ephesians 5, it says, "Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself for her." And but Isaac was not heroic. And obviously, he was a man of his times. So he loved his wife in whatever way he loved her, but it was not like the sacrificial love of Jesus, who would die for her. Jesus said, "Greater love has no one than this, that he'd die for his friends." So I don't want to die for her, so I just said she was my sister. And Abimelech, by the way, Abimelech—that's the same name as the king in of the same city in chapter 20. And this, you know, chapter 20, when Abraham went down there and Abimelech took Sarah into his harem, that was before the birth of Isaac. And now Isaac is, what, at least 60. So is this the same Abimelech? And by the way, the Abimelech in chapter 20 was attracted to a woman who was 90 years old. So he may have been an old guy then, and now this is at least 60 years later, maybe more. So it's probably a different Abimelech. And many feel that this was that Abimelech might have been even a title rather than a personal name, a little bit like Pharaoh in Egypt, that the king of Egypt's always called Pharaoh, no matter who he is, no matter what his proper name is, he's always Pharaoh. And that the Philistine leaders of Gerar were apparently, were possibly always called Abimelech, whoever they were. Might have been Abimelech the first, Abimelech the second, even, and the third and fourth. There's also later on, he's got names, like in verse 26, it's going to say that Phicol, the commander of his army, came with Abimelech to make a deal with Isaac. Well, the earlier Abimelech in chapter 20 also had a commander of his army named Phicol. So Phicol might have also been more of a title or a rank or something, rather than a personal name. Anyway, Abimelech said, "What is this you've done to us?" Verse 10. "One of the people might soon have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt on us." So Abimelech charged all his people, saying, "He who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." Now, this is interesting, because these Philistines, who are uncircumcised, unclean pagans, they show some moral, you know, fiber. He says, "Okay, now that we know she's your wife, no one can touch her. Now, Isaac's concern was that if he had admitted she was his wife, they would kill him to take her. But obviously, that was not what they were inclined to do. Now, some people in some cultures had done such things. In Egypt, there's a well-known story that archaeologists have discovered called the Tale of Two Brothers that tells of an actual case where a man was killed because someone wanted his wife. And it's from that general period. Abraham probably knew that story and feared that. Isaac too. But remember in chapter 20, when Abimelech said to Abraham, "Why did you deceive us like this?" Abraham said, "Because I thought there's no fear of God in this place." But there was. Abimelech did fear God. He didn't know the true God, but when God revealed himself to him, he feared him and he obeyed him. And likewise, this man, perhaps the son of the other one, seems to have some scruples too. And now that it's come out that Rebekah is Isaac's wife, he makes a decree. No one is allowed to harm this man or touch his wife. For a pagan, that's pretty commendable, it seems like. And so Isaac sowed in the land. Now, sowing seed was not something that Abraham had done. He had wandered. You don't farm if you're wandering around from place to place. He's a sheep herder. He was a Bedouin. He was a nomadic shepherd. That's what Abraham was. And a sheikh at that. He was very powerful. And Isaac was all those things too. But now, because of the famine, he settles in one area for a while and decides, well, while I'm here, might as well lease some property and sow some seed, see what comes of it. And it says, and he was new at this farming stuff, but he sowed seed in the land. And it says, the same year he reaped 100-fold. And Yahweh blessed him. Now, 100-fold is a very large crop. Very unusual. I mean, it's not impossible, but it's a bumper crop for sure. And yet it was a famine time. Presumably it was, a drought. And yet God gave him such a huge crop. Because God did tell him, you don't go to Egypt, you stay here, I'll bless you in the land here. So even though other people were not getting good crops, Isaac was. God was giving special attention to his farm and giving him a lot of produce. And so he began to prosper and continued prospering until he became very prosperous. For he had possessions of flocks and possessions of herds and great number of servants, so the Philistines envied him. See, if he had all this grain in a time of famine, well, other people didn't have grain, so they had to buy it from someone. And he was the one who seemed to be the grain magnet of the area. And so people would come and they would trade with him gold and silver and livestock in order to get grain. And so he was accumulating, he not only had a lot of grain that he grew, but he was accumulating all these other kinds of wealth by trading in the area until he was the most powerful man in the area. And the Philistines were intimidated by him. They were jealous of him. So they envied him. Now the Philistines had stopped up all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham, his father, and they had filled them with earth. In all likelihood, these wells were the source of the water that watered his crops. He didn't, in all likelihood, have, there was apparently no rain going on. And therefore, his servants would have to be drawing water out of wells and pouring it on the crops. That's a pretty slow and tedious way to water your crops. And the Philistines, jealous of him, not liking the fact that he was advancing in wealth so much, would go and fill up the wells with mud to make it, obviously to try to thwart this prosperity and this blessing that was going on in his life. But it didn't work. God still blessed him. But it says, Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are much mightier than we." And it's possible that the Philistines didn't exist in large numbers in Palestine at that time. We know the Philistines had been in the area for some time, but their cities might have been small. And if Isaac inherited all the servants Abram had had, plus he's getting all this new prosperity, he could easily be a tremendous and formidable force to be reckoned with in the area. And the Philistines felt like he was actually more powerful than them. Then Isaac departed from there and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. And Isaac dug again the wells of water which they dug in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. He called them by the names which his father had called them. Also Isaac's servants dug in the valley, and found a well of running water there. But the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water's ours." So he called the name of the well Esek, which means quarrel, because they quarreled with him. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over that one also. So he called its name Sitna, which means hatred or enmity. So it looks like he's abandoning these wells as soon as there's contention over them. He redigs his father's wells, and then he digs a few of his own, but they quarrel over so he doesn't get to keep them. He abandons them and just names them quarreling and hatred. But then he moved from there and dug another well, so they did not quarrel over it. So they called that one Rehoboth, which means spaciousness or room, because he said, "For now Yahweh has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." Now, see, to be fruitful in the land, apparently to produce crops, they needed these wells. And so he says, now we've got a place. We've got this well here. There's water in it. No one's fighting us for it. So this is where we can settle in and be fruitful, since we've had to leave the former farm site. Then he went up from there to Beersheba. And the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, for I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for my servant Abraham's sake." So he built an altar there and called on the name of Yahweh and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well also. Now that was a redigging of the well. There was already a well there. It was called Beersheba, which means the well of the oath. And it was named that, remember, when Abram had received or had given 7 ewe lambs to Abimelech, because there was dispute over well on that occasion too. This is back, you know, in chapter 20, when Abram said, "Your servants took this well from me," and Abimelech said, I didn't know about anything about it. I haven't heard about it until just now." And so Abram said, "Well, it's my well, and I'm going to give you these 7 ewe lambs, and when you receive them, that's a token of you agreeing that it's mine." And an oath was made there, and they called it the well of the oath. Actually, the word Beersheba, Sheba can mean oath, or it can also mean 7. So it could be called the well of 7. The well of the 7, the 7 ewe lambs that were exchanged there. But it seems to be a play on words because they made an oath there too. So Beersheba can mean the well of the oath or the well of the 7. And so he redigs that well again, and calls it by the same name Abram had called it. Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with Ahuzath, one of his friends, and Phicol, the commander of his army. And Isaac said to them, "Why have you come to me, since you hate me and have sent me away from you?" But they said, "We have certainly seen that the Lord is with you." Now they say Yahweh. Interesting. We've seen that Yahweh was with you. The Philistines didn't worship Yahweh. They worshiped Dagon, a god that was depicted as a fish with a man's body. And Dagon was obviously a demon god. But the various nations accepted in general the actual existence of the other gods of the other nations. They just felt there was a tribal loyalty that each tribe or each nation felt to the god of their group. And yet they did not dispute that the gods of other groups were real gods. And so for the Philistines to acknowledge Yahweh as a real god is not strange, even though they weren't worshippers of Yahweh. They knew that Isaac and his family were worshippers of this Yahweh, and that Yahweh was blessing them, and they had no problem acknowledging and giving credit to Yahweh for that. And they said, "We have certainly seen that Yahweh is with you. So we said, let there now be an oath between us, between you and us. Let us make a covenant with you." In other words, we're intimidated by you. God's blessing you. We're afraid you might, you know, decide that you're strong enough to overthrow us. Let's make an agreement that that won't happen. Now, that should be unnecessary, because in chapter 20, Abraham made that same oath with the earlier Abimelech, and it had included their offspring. That is, they said, "Neither, my sons will not afflict your sons," and so forth. So the oath that Abraham made should have been binding here. We see then Isaac making an oath that's exactly like the one his father made too. Again, everything that Isaac does that's recorded is just a redoing of things Abraham did. And so He says, let us make a covenant with you, verse 29, that you will do us no harm,